It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Eating and mindfulness. Is there a connection? Well, ABC News anchor Dan Harris thinks so. He's the best-selling author of the book 10% Happier. He has evidence that meditation can help us control mindless eating.
If you can take just a few seconds to notice what you're eating and how it tastes, you will enjoy it a lot more than you will if you're simultaneously sending emails. And if you're noticing what you're eating and noticing how full you are at any given moment, you may not eat as much.
Now, on the cooking side, how about a chef's lesson in mindful and super practical cooking? Chef Ronna Welsh teaches sustainable and creative ways of wasting less. Stick around, there's lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. So, what does enduring a panic attack on live national TV in front of 5 million people, a healthy sense of skepticism, and a reporter's instincts add up to? Well, for ABC anchorman Dan Harris, it turned into the best-selling book, 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works. Contributor David Leet talked to Dan about how, in his search to understand that TV meltdown, he stumbled upon the power of meditation. It improved his health, and interestingly, it affected how he eats.
Hey, Dan, it's nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
So, I'm sure you're familiar with the phrase, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. So, what was the first step that took you on this journey of meditation?
The first thing was that I had a panic attack on national television, and this was in June of 2004. I was reading the news updates on Good Morning America, and I just basically lost the ability to breathe, and I had to quit right in the middle, and it was extremely, extremely embarrassing.
Yeah, it was hard to watch.
The root of it was that I had spent many years overseas covering wars for ABC News in the early part of the 2000s, you know, after 9/11, I was in Iraq and Afghanistan and the Middle East. And when I got home, I got depressed, mm-hmm. and I just made a very, very dumb decision, which was I self-medicated with recreational drugs. And even though this was a very brief period of time, and I never did it when I was working and definitely not when I was on the air, after I had the panic attack, I learned from my doctor that the drugs I was using raised the level of adrenaline in my brain and primed me to have this panic attack. And so that moment of figuring out what a moron I'd been really set this whole thing in motion.
So on this journey, you talked about many things in the book. And I'm curious, how does meditation and being 10% happier, to use the title of your book, connected with food and eating?
So one of the things that meditation, which, by the way, I always thought was uniquely ridiculous and only for people who were, you know, collectors of crystal or really into, you know, ultimate frisbee, as it turns out, it's just simple brain exercise. And one of the things it does for you is make you more aware of what's happening in your mind at any given moment so that you're not carried away by it, mm-hmm. which, if you think about it, is a superpower, because we're often yanked around by our urges and impulses, which is what has us losing our temper and regretting it later, checking our email when we're supposed to be listening to our children, and doing things like putting our hand in the fridge when we're not actually hungry.
Right.
And so there is a direct bearing on how much we eat and how much we enjoy it from meditation.
So do you think that people who are meditating are more aware of what they're eating and therefore maybe can control their eating patterns?
Correct. Although I have to say that I've been meditating for a couple of years, and I still, last night I overdid it at dinner, and it's not uncommon for me to do that, hence the name of the book, 10% Happier. I'm certainly not claiming to be an avatar of perfection, but meditation or mindfulness, which is the term of art, the ability to see what's going on in your head without being carried away by it, that can be directly targeted at eating and has been by scientists and researchers, and it's been shown to work.
So by that same token then, can meditating and being more mindful create more pleasure when you're eating?
Absolutely. Think about how often you eat while doing other things.
Often.
Yeah. I mean, I do it all the time still, but if you can take just a few seconds to notice what you're eating and how it tastes, you will enjoy it a lot more than you will if you're simultaneously sending emails. And by the way, if you're noticing what you're eating and noticing how full you are at any given moment, you may not eat as much. And one of the reasons why diets often fail is that there's a feeling of deprivation, either a feeling of deprivation or a fear of deprivation. And with mindful eating, the trick is that you're supposed to be, you're supposed to reach a pleasant satiety, and you need the mental wherewithal, the mindfulness, to notice when you've reached that point.
So I think the big question everyone has is, how do we do this? How do we go on our own personal magical mystery tour?
I don't think it's complicated. First of all, it doesn't involve joining any group, paying any money, believing in anything in particular, or wearing special outfits. I'm talking about 5 minutes a day of completely secular meditation, which can coexist with whatever your faith is, or work with people who are like me, agnostics. And I think it will change the relationship in your life to the voice in your head that yanks you around and has you doing all the things that many of us live to regret, like eating too much, or in my case, in a very sort of high-profile example, making some bad personal decisions that blow up on your face on national television. And I can teach you how to do it in fewer letters than it takes to send a tweet.
Sure. Okay. So tell me.
Okay. So I'm going to give you a slightly longer version than the tweet version, but it's still pretty short. Three steps. First, sit with your spine straight and your eyes closed. I say have your spine straight. You don't have to get militant about it. It's mostly just because I don't want you to fall asleep. The second step is to notice, where do you feel your breath most prominently? Your nose, your chest, your belly. Try to focus on the feeling of the breath coming in and going out. There's nothing special about the breath except that it's always there unless, you know, you're in real trouble. So it's something very portable that you can focus on, and it's portable and perennial. You can focus on it all the time. So you're focusing on your breath, and the third step is the key. Your mind, you will find, is going to wander to a million things, like, why am I doing this? What am I going to have for lunch? Why did I say that stupid thing to my boss? Every time your mind wanders, catch yourself and bring your focus back to the breath. And when you do that, you are breaking a lifetime of habit of walking around in a fog of memory and projection and actually focusing on what's going right on right now. And that's a bicep curl for your brain.
And that's it.
That's it. I mean, you just, it's a series of failures and then finding the grit to start over again.
Well, Dan, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure to join you. And as I've said to you, your pictures of food on the internet make me want to mindlessly eat.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Dan Harris is author of 10% Happier. David Leet is publisher of Leet's Culinaria, lccooks.com. Relentless in their search for the best in fish shacks, barbecue joints, and supper clubs, Jane and Michael Stern track good home food no matter where it takes them. They're the duo behind roadfood.com, and they join us here regularly. Jane, Michael, good to have you back with us.
Great to be here.
Hi, Lynn.
So, latest finds?
Oh, I'm just gonna swoon.
Are you swoon while I talk?
Right.
Jane
I'm
is swooning,
really swooning.
And I'm gonna talk about Devalsbluff, Arkansas, which we have spoken about before with you, Lynn. We've spoken about the family pie shop, a great little kind of shed where they make wonderful pies. Well,
right.
Around the corner from the family pie shop is Ms. Lena's pie shop. It's literally a house trailer. And from this house trailer come the most delicious Southern-style fried pies I have ever tasted.
You know, I think a fried pie needs or deserves an explanation for those who have never been fortunate enough to run into one.
You're absolutely right. I mentioned it to somebody, and he said the first thing he thought of in his mind was taking an entire pie and somehow frying it. That's not what we're talking about here.
These look like...
Well, it's like a big empanada, for example.
Or a little empanada.
Or a little empanada.
Right. It's basically a wonderful, savory, rich, brittle crust, a pie crust, into which has been put many different types of fillings. And Miss Lena's specializes in apple fried pies. So this is hand food. You don't eat it with a knife and fork.
Right.
They're fried right when you order them. And they are, I would have to say, of all the gazillion road food restaurants that Michael and I have written about over the years, if somebody wanted to challenge us to see if we were, in fact, the best food writers in the world, we would send them to Miss Lena's, and they would come back and they would bow at our feet, because this is truly the best road food ever.
Well, it's – I mean, the crust, I think they must use – I don't know if it's fried in lard or what, but the crust has that wonderful kind of savory, real flavor to it. It's thin, it's brittle, it's fragile. It's really kind of quite elegant, given that it's a deep-fried thing. And inside of that, I mean, Jane likes the apple. Personally, apricot for me. I mean, this really tastes like apricots. I mean, sunny, sweet apricots inside this crust. I mean, what more do you want?
Well, what more do you want? How about the Hunter pie, which is which I would want that too. It's chocolate and cherries blended with marshmallows and then fried.
And I thought you were going to say it was, you know, some sort of meat or whatever.
No.
Deer meat and marshmallows.
I get it.
Why
get
it is called a hunter's pie, who knows.
But explain what this place looks like,
okay,
Michael.
It is literally a house trailer, and there is no place to eat inside of it. We went there with a large group of people, and basically there wasn't room for more than three or four of us at one time inside the trailer. You get your fried pies, which are eminently portable. You need no utensils. And you walk outside and stand around in front of the trailer and enjoy the pies.
It sounds perfectly reasonable.
It's really one of the great places ever.
Arkansas is one of the really overlooked food destinations.
For pies and for barbecue, it has some of the best in the country.
It sounds fabulous. Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye-bye,
okay, Lynn. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of the classic guide, Road Food. Check out their Sleeves Up dining picks at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Australian cook Donna Hay and being more mindful in the kitchen. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know that clean, white, minimalist look in so many food photos? How that dish lures you out of the jumble of your life into a perfect world? Well, this is the mark of a woman some call a conceptual genius. Donna Hay is Australia's one-woman food, publishing, and lifestyle powerhouse. Her design sense influences food publications worldwide, and to boot, her food's a turn-on. Uncannily simple, but vivid with flavors and good looks. Well, our contributor Dori Greenspan caught up with Donna in New York with her new book, Donna Hay, Fresh and Light.
Donna, it's great to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Do you know, it's interesting to me that everything that I read about you and that I see refers to your recipes as design-driven.
Strong words, design-driven.
They are strong, and I see them often, and I'm curious, where did it come from?
Well, I guess working in publishing, in one dimension. It's different to sell people your recipes and your food. So my thing is that I've always written books for people to cook at home and to encourage them to cook at home. So I don't have a restaurant. I'm not a chef. It's not like you can come to the restaurant and what you're ordering appears in front of you. You can see it, you can smell it, and then you taste it. You're totally sold. What I've got to get you to do to go to the kitchen is that you look at the picture, your mouth starts to water. Then you go to the recipe, you realize that you possibly have some of those ingredients already in the kitchen, or you know where to buy the remaining ones. You look at the method, it's quite short, it's really well written, it's really simple. So that was my hook, that design-driven doesn't mean that I'm thinking about the plate before the recipe. I want to design the recipe so that your mouth waters, you know you can achieve it, and I'm going to get you to cook.
You're going to hook us.
Absolutely.
But there is, in all of your work, an aesthetic that I find very beautiful. It's pure, it's light, it's focused on the food. Was this your aesthetic from the beginning? Is this your personal style? It's totally yours.
Yeah, it is. When I branched out on my own, this is what I wanted to do. I wanted it to be clean and light, and I wanted it to be a celebration about the food and the produce and the beautiful freshness. I didn't want it to be about flowers and napkin rings and glasses and whatever else was in the shot back in the day when I was first starting out. So it was kind of hard for some people to take when I first started doing it.
Oh, that's interesting, because now we look at it and we see the food. I, for one, don't miss the glasses and the flowers. But it's interesting to understand how you thought about this and what you were really aiming for.
It's going to be a slightly long answer, but when I was growing up and I first started in the food world, writing recipes and assisting stylists and really getting my feet on the ground, my friends worked in fashion assistants, interiors assistants, beauty assistants had very glamorous jobs. But the thing we were missing is that we were the first generation of dual working parents. So my friends had spent no time in the kitchen. Their mums weren't really home. You know, we were just a different generation, a new time. So when I started cooking and we had all moved out of home and, you know, we had our tiny little apartments and we were making do, I would invite them over for dinner and I would cook, you know, quite basic things like a roast chicken or some lovely couscous or a pasta dish. And they would be constantly asking me how to do the recipe. You know, how do you do that? How do you roast a chicken? What temperature? Because they had absolutely no cooking skills. So when I decided to pair back the photography and the styling, it also had another really, really important angle to it, is that when I say chop the chili or shred the basil, you can actually see it in the picture because it's all about the food. So instead of having to do quite monotonous step-by-step photography, when the pictures are clear and crisp, then you can see, you know, it's another driver to get you to cook.
You have a knack for just scooping up the best from around the world. And your recipes incorporate global flavors. You use ingredients that come from all over.
Yes. I'm the flavor thief.
The flavor thief. That's a great term.
Well, you know, I think there's really great flavors that are really worth their salt, for a better pun, that you can take from different cuisines without having to do traditional things with them. Like preserved lemons, for example, it's so much more complex than just lemon rind. It has that more rounded flavor, but it doesn't just lend itself to Middle Eastern cooking, Turkish cooking, whatever. You know, that's a great flavor that goes with basil, with lots of herbs. It's great on the barbecue. So I like to find, because I don't want you to have to go out and shop for too many ingredients, I really like to hook on to those ingredients that are really punchy and do a, you know, they're a fabulous base to start with when you're writing a recipe.
Well, as the preserved lemon, what are, let's say, five ingredients that we should all have in our pantries that will just brighten up dishes?
Well, the five things that I would have are probably cheat shortcuts, because I am really, really reliant on my fabulous friendships I have. So I'm always inviting people over. But what I really want to do is share some food and maybe a glass of wine with them and have a good old long chat and a laugh or two. So I try and have things in my pantry and especially in the refrigerator that if I do invite someone over and on a whim, that I do have some really good flavors. And I think depending on what cuisines you like to cook, you know, there's some great Asian sort of chili jam paste and things like that, and the miso paste and mirin or some sort of Chinese cooking wine. All of that in the Asian kind of genre is fabulous to have on standbys. I even have kaffir lime leaves in the freezer because I think shredding those up and just putting them through a green vegetable stir fry just makes it so vibrant and so tasty.
Such a particular flavor, that lime leaf.
Yep. Yeah. And then I have the other kind of end where I have, you know, a great mustard in the fridge, my preserved lemons in there, and then I always have a big wedge of parmesan. Just for the other spectrum of more Mediterranean style cooking. And I think having, you know, I'm always saved by having some herbs of growing quality, which aren't always great. I'm not the best gardener, but I always try and keep some sort of herb going in the garden as well, just as a little backup savior.
Just something fresh on the top.
Yeah, something to stir through just to give it some vibrancy.
Delicious. Thank you so much for coming in. It's been great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Donna Hay is the author of Donna Hay Fresh and Light. Dori Greenspan is the author of Around My French Table and Baking Chez Moi. Well, Donna left us with a recipe for ginger poached chicken with fennel and apple slaw. Find it at splendidtables.org. If you're someone who works on living a more mindful life, we've got a suggestion. Spend a day stacking up all the things you throw away in the kitchen. Onion and garlic skins, tea bags, trimmings from carrots and celery, chicken bones. You'd be surprised at how big that heap can be. Chef Ronna Welsh teaches cooking classes in her Brooklyn-based Purple Kale Kitchen Works. At the very heart of her classes are sustainable and creative ways of wasting less. There's lots of practical tips, but also a psychological approach to cooking that's bigger than just composting. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, got a lesson.
Ronna, thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
Hey, so what do you think we need to understand to be more sustainable in our kitchens?
In my opinion, we're only going to adopt sustainable cooking habits, and these are habits that are conscious of the environment, of food waste, of local economies, things that go beyond just buying the right kind of food from the right source. If they fit, if these habits fit into and work around the ups, the downs, the urgencies, the mishaps, the wackiness of everyday life.
So give me an example of that.
Well, I think this, you know, really moves way beyond the way we typically script out our meals. And so we approach dinner even by asking what's for dinner and then sending us down a path of figuring out what to procure in order to cook what it is we set out to eat. But I think we need an approach that flips this whole process of meal planning, asking what's for dinner on its head, and that begins with great ingredients, sharp attention to how they taste, to their texture. They're sometimes hard to see discrete parts. And then often using really basic cooking technique, methodically follow their lead beyond one particular dish to possibly many different dishes or many different meals.
So you're saying don't plan on, you know, don't take a recipe and go to the grocery store. You're thinking that's the backward approach to it.
Well, I think if that's our only approach, then it fails us for when life happens.
So give me an example. You have some wonderful examples on your blog about things you can do with single ingredients. You've taken apart an apple, for instance. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. When I tackle an apple, I have kids, and so by tackling an apple, that means I have to, by necessity, peel it for them. And so when I peel that apple and I'm left with this beautiful flesh, I'm also left with a pile of peels.
Mm-hmm.
And the obvious thing is we're supposed to all save our scraps. And so I save them, and I might put them in a low oven to dry them or even take them. And if I did a really thoughtful job peeling, that is, I peeled them knowing that they might have some interesting use for me, and therefore I kept some of the flesh on the peel itself, then they might be flavorful enough to serve as a basis of a slaw in combination with cabbage or something. And if I have that same kind of attention paid to how I cut the apple, so that rather than lob it in half and just kind of prick out the seeds, I might cut the flesh away from the core, so that not only am I left with these nice big chunks of apples to snack on, but I have a chunky, meaty core, which then I could put in a pot and cook down in any number of ways. And one of the ways that I documented was just cooking it with some vinegar and sugar. And it makes this really astounding gastrique, which is simply a sweet and sour sauce, the sweetness coming from the apple cores themselves.
It's so interesting because, of course, what you're talking about, some people would consider sloppy prep, right? That you're leaving so much flesh with the peel, and you're, you know, not getting all of the flesh off the core. And in reality, you're changing the whole system. It's such a mindful way to look at the ingredient.
Well, I think that, you know, I like to say that there's more food in the food we eat than we typically see.
And it is a very optimistic approach.
It is, because it's our mental state which prevents us from cooking, and not our skill set.
Yeah, you're right.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not about being inspired, because the truth is inspiration never strikes between 6 and 8 p.m. and everyone is hungry, and you have to eat.
Those are wise words. Rana, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Sally.
Chef Rana Welsh teaches classes at her Purple Kale Kitchen Works in Brooklyn, New York. Be sure to check out her Apple in 4X. Find the info at splendidtable.org.
Hello, who's that speaking, please?
We are connecting with you. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. And, of course, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Zach is on the line from Nashville. Zach, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing well, too. I was just calling in to get some advice. I'm getting married in September, and my fiancé and I, within the next couple of weeks, are going to be doing the whole ritual of registering for gifts.
Right.
We both like to cook, and we both enjoy being in the kitchen and experimenting and doing all kinds of things. And she's a vegetarian. I'm not. But we just both enjoy cooking. But we kind of have a little bit of a different approach to what we're registering for. She's the more practical. Every, you know, fancy gadget that I pick out, she doesn't want to burden people with buying us those things. and you know, I have a Vitamix and I have all these things. And, you know, the big thing that we're fighting over is the KitchenAid stand mixer. It's like, I really want one. She just thinks it's impractical and I can just use a hand mixer. But regardless, what I was wondering if you had any advice, some different things that we might be able to put on the registry that we might not be thinking about right now, or some things that are just really essential to our kitchen for both of us that is practical, but at the same time is going to let us have a little fun that we might not think about.
Okay, let's see. Well, I'm just thinking in my head about what ends up in my sink most often. Yeah, because if you think about it, that's what you use the most.
Right. Well,
what happens is a lot of people, when you're two people, you think small. You know, an 8-inch or a 10-inch skillet or sauté pan instead of the 12-inch. But the 12-inch sauté pan, not saying you don't want one smaller one or two maybe, but the 12-inch sauté pan is the pan that you can do a lot of things for just two, but you can do a pasta sauce in it for 8 to 10. You can make a stew in that. And what I was thinking of, one of the things that a lot of people don't think of is really big stainless steel mixing bowls, like 8-quart mixing bowls, because I find I use mine constantly. I use them in the sink to soak vegetables. I use it for beating even small quantities of things. You know, when you want to beat 4 eggs, I don't like small bowls because I'm very sloppy. I have, you know, when I beat something, I throw myself into it. So these big bowls, I can just take a whisk and go crazy with it. So that would be one thing. And the other thing is, whenever you buy a bowl of any kind, like a mixing bowl, when you go to select which one you want, find a whisk. Not saying you're going to always use a whisk, but a whisk with a heavy handle, and put it in the bowl, because a lot of these bowls tip. And you want one that has a really sturdy bottom. That's one thing. The other thing I use all the time is my rolled steel or cast steel flat-bottomed 14 to 16-inch wok. I use it all the time. The other thing I use constantly, I mean every night practically, are really heavy duty, and they're commercial grade with these thick rolled edges, half sheet pans. And I line them with foil. I roast in them. I broil in them. I dry things in them. And they just, you know, they're flat. They just slide into a cupboard or into a drawer. And I have two of them because one's always, you know, being washed. Is that the kind of thing you're looking for, the kind of advice you're looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. And what made me call in, I heard you, you know, talking to somebody, I think, about roasting in one of those pans that you said, and it just made me think, like, well, I would never thought about that, so I just want to call in and get some ideas. And that's perfect advice. What, you know, what's in the sink most is what you're going
right.
to be if you don't have it. So
may you two know all the joy that can possibly be and cook together for a very long time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Zach. Goodbye. We're going to be back in a minute with more of your questions and an update on one of the most serious issues in the ocean, dead zones. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, we're going to get back to your questions. Connect with us at 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Liz is calling from Hudson, Wisconsin. Liz, what is on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I need to get some feedback and some suggestions for making a stew for this Jewish Sabbath. The dilemma that I have is that I put the soup in a slow cooker on a Friday evening before sundown.
Right, of course.
And it stays in that slow cooker throughout the evening and the morning. And then at noon hour on Saturday, when we come back from services, we sit down with our company and supposedly have a luscious stew. The problem is the traditional recipes for chameen or cholent, these stews, are very, very meaty, and I want a vegetarian version. And I've been trying and trying and trying with no luck. And every time I open the lid at the table and our guests are sitting there, and what I see and what I taste is simply not edible. It's overcooked,
mush,
overboiled, dead vegetable broth. And and the only thing that has ever made it taste a little better is a good helping of tamarind, you know, that I put in.
Right.
But I'm wondering if you might have any suggestions for a vegetarian stew that would sit in a slow cooker overnight to be served on Saturday lunch.
Okay. Now, you have to start it before sundown.
Yes.
So this may still mush up. You know, the problem always is that meat breaks down more slowly than almost anything in the vegetable world. But let's think for a minute. Now, one of the things that's going to what I'm about to say is an ingredient of which there are hundreds of varieties, and you can season it thousands of ways. Beans, dry beans. I do them in a slow cooker all the time, and I throw in with them. Now, this is the way it generally works, okay? You do them at high for – you just set it for like 5.5 hours, okay? Now, the longest cooking bean, the one that takes the most time, and the one that holds up best is the chickpea.
Mm-hmm.
And the chickpea is, you know, it's sweet. It's delicious. It makes a broth that will make you weep. It's so sweet and good. And of course, like all beans, it's a sponge. It'll absorb all kinds of flavorings. If you add some acid, the tamarind is an example, wine is an example, of the obvious things, you know, citrus, etc., that keeps beans hard.
Oh.
But if it's cooked long enough, because we're talking here more than 12 hours, right?
Yeah.
We may end up with something that is still has some firmness, and you could have vegetables in it that melt into it, but they'll be delicious. And, I mean, you could – there's so many directions you can go in here. For instance, are you familiar with Moroccan food?
Yes.
Okay. You know the typical – vegetable stew with big chunks of different vegetables that is often served with couscous.
Yeah.
And the seasoning there is often things like cinnamon and paprika and cumin and coriander and, you know, green herbs like fresh coriander as well, and lemon and almonds and raisins. Now, some of that is going to melt in, but that basic idea, and there's tomato in there usually too. Now, the tomato has enough acid in it to slow down the bean process. That would be a fabulous thing to have. And the couscous could actually be at room temperature. The couscous could be something that you do the day before. You put it in the refrigerator, you take it out, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can spoon over that couscous this hot liquid, or you can just serve it in bowls because it'll be thick. So that's one way to go. And I would set the slow cooker on high for about 8 hours. And then the rest of the time, it'll stay on warm.
Okay. And I have tried this with canned chickpeas, and it was disastrous.
So yeah, no. The dried – normally, if you're doing a dried chickpea, and don't soak it. That's the other thing. Don't soak it. It just goes into the pot with your liquid, and your liquid could be vegetable broth, it could be plain water. I would put onion in it, I would put garlic in it, I would put all kinds of seasonings. I do an herb blend of cinnamon sticks, whole allspice, paprika, usually a mixture of hot and sweet, clove, black pepper, fairly generous amount of it, and some fennel, you know, fennel seeds, and I throw that into a coffee grinder. And I grind it. And whatever else I want. For instance, I love cumin seeds because cumin seeds have an orange overtone to them.
Mm-hmm.
And you could throw orange rind, big strips of orange rind, into the pot too. Because that, with the tomatoes and the seasonings and whatever, is going to be delicious. That goes in at the very beginning of the cooking.
I know what I'm making this Saturday.
The one thing I would advise, because I have never cooked the beans at high for that long a period of time, but I wouldn't want to leave them at low for a terrifically long period of time because they could ferment. I don't want to have any spoilage. I would do a small test run in your slow cooker with the dried beans tonight.
All righty.
Okay, but seriously, I think this is going to work for you.
And in terms of proportion, I got rid of my old slow cooker because I thought there was something wrong with it. I thought the temperature was off, so I bought a brand new one that is programmable, so I can certainly put it on high for 8 hours, and then it switches automatically to warm, which
right.
is perfect. What? How much dry chickpeas?
You generally want to make sure you have enough liquid to cover those beans by about 2 inches, 2 to 2.5 inches. You can always spoon it down. Now, once the sun has risen, you can cook?
No.
No.
Once,
okay.
On Friday night, as the sun is setting, it has to be on and just
right.
and I leave it alone. And that's it.
That's it. Okay, fine. But I'd rather you – I don't want you to have to go there to do anything. So I would make sure you have about 2.5 inches of liquid covering it.
Okay.
All right?
Oh, yum.
Yeah, and remember, beans are sponges. They absorb seasoning. So don't hesitate to over-season. Taste the liquid.
Okay.
And don't hesitate to add salt.
Alrighty.
A bit of salt. It should, you know, the liquid should taste like it's well seasoned on every level.
Excellent.
Don't kill it, but just a little more than you might normally use.
Okay.
Okay, and I use a lot.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
I think you're going to really enjoy this.
I'll send
you
an email how it turns out.
Oh, please do. Please do, Liz. Okay?
Okay, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
I appreciate it.
You are welcome.
Okay, then.
Bye.
Bye.
You can send us an email, splendidtable.org, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Kira is calling from Long Beach, New York. Kira, welcome. What do you want to talk?
Liz.
Hi. What do you want to talk about?
So I lived in San Francisco a few years ago, and a friend of mine was from India, and his mom would send him jars of condiments from India. And he would sample different ones. And one of them was so delicious, and I can't figure out what it's called, but I know what the ingredients were. I was hoping you could help me.
What are the ingredients?
So it was a mashed up kind of chunky paste of mango and chili peppers, but it was really sour, almost like it was pickled, and it was really hot, almost like an umeboshi plum paste, but
with
mango.
And the mango, now the mangoes weren't sweet, they were sour.
Yeah, and a little salty.
Okay, this was, I can't think of the name, but I can tell you some of the places to go to find the name.
Sure.
But what they're using is an unripe mango, which you've probably figured out. You know, when a mango is really hard as a rock.
Yeah.
It will tend to have that quality. Also, some tamarind might have been added.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, especially, was it sort of a mahogany red color?
I can't remember, honestly. I think it was just an orange color, but it had that sourness like tamarind.
Yeah, but sometimes, you know, an unripe mango can be fairly sour, too. But,
yeah.
But, have some tamarind paste around when you fool around with this. Okay,
sure.
A couple of sources. There's one Indian food expert and author that I like a great deal is Raghavan Iyer. It's I-Y-E-R. He's done several books, but the one that I would say if you buy nothing else or you look into nothing else would be his 660 curries.
Okay.
And I think, because he has a lot of chutneys in there, a lot of pickles, I think you would find it there.
That's great.
Check out anything by Madhur Jaffrey. Okay, because she has written reams about Indian food. Julie Sahni, S-A-A-H-N-I. Now, Julie hasn't published, if I recall, recently, but she did. Her first book, I think, was called The Art of Indian Cooking. Anything by her is going to be really dependable, and all of these people really do their homework. And they're from the culture. Yeah, check those three out, and I think you'll find the correct name.
You know, I'll try the tamarind when I try to make it.
Yeah, try the tamarind. The chili is kind of obvious, but try the tamarind.
Yeah.
Just have it. You may only need a little bit to give you that sour taste.
Okay?
I think you're
wonderful. I listen every week. You really brighten my day every time.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
You've just brightened mine. Have fun with it.
Excellent.
Take care. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye. Remember, you can call us anytime. 800-537-5252, and you can shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. 3 years ago, I interviewed Dr. Eric Prince. Now, he's a research fisheries biologist at NOAA's Southeast Fisheries Science Center. He told a startling story. He and his colleagues found that a dead zone, meaning an area of the ocean with very little oxygen, had developed in the Atlantic, and it was huge. It spread from the east coast of South America across the ocean to the west coast of Africa, and it was the size of North America. Well, Dr. Prince is with us with an update of what's happened over these past 3 years. Eric, it's good to have you back with us.
Nice to be back, Lynn.
Now, to do a quick catch-up, could you explain what you had found that you were telling us about in that interview in 2011?
Well, we published the paper that I discussed with you last time. It was published in Fisheries Oceanography in 2010. That paper focused on the Atlantic Ocean, much smaller than the Pacific Ocean, which had already documented oxygen minimum zones results in hypoxia-based habitat compression.
Meaning zones in the ocean where there was no oxygen in the water.
Right. Well, or very little.
Oh, very little. Okay.
Yes. And so only the animals in the surface mixed layer, they call it, above the thermocline, you know, there's a tremendously productive population of animals in that zone, but not much below. That was really the essence of it, that everything we found previously in our previous paper in the eastern tropical Pacific, we also found very much applied to the eastern tropical Atlantic as well. Only it was a smaller body of water. The hypoxia and the OMZ, as we call it, the oxygen minimum zone, wasn't as large, and it wasn't quite as hypoxic, meaning a little bit of oxygen, but not enough to support the tropical pelagic predators that we work with.
What's pelagic?
It's actually an oceanographic term applied to animals that are where there's not a bottom and they're in the upper waters of the water column, and that's where they live.
So they live near the surface?
Near the surface in the open water.
What accounts for this change?
Well, it's a whole series of things that happen. Basically, it's a phenomena that occurs on the west coast of continents where the meteorological factors, including winds that parallel coastlines. And these winds eventually turn into what's called the Ekman spiral, and they end up pushing water off the coast, the surface water off the coast, and allowing deep, nutrient-rich water, but very hypoxic with no oxygen, to come to the surface and mix.
Ah.
It occurs basically in the equatorial waters of the world, except right at the equator, there's two currents that go against each other that tend to mix a small little area there, and it ventilates the waters below the thermocline with oxygen. But everything else is pretty much squeezed into a very shallow area near the surface of the ocean. And so that's what they call hypoxia-based habitat compression. And the very thin, very steep temperature gradient of those thermoclines in these areas, there's also a cold shock to very small animals that don't have the bulk. And so it acts sort of as for the small sardines and anchovies, for those different families of animals we call the preferred prey of the tropical pelagic predators,
mm-hmm.
those guys are too small to deal with the temperature, no less dissolved oxygen change that exists below that thermocline. That population of prey is really stuck. In some cases, certain species of tuna have adapted to low ambient dissolved oxygen. In other cases, animals like swordfish have also adapted to low oxygen. They can live below the thermocline,
mm-hmm.
but they come up to feed on this highly dense, you know, prey species. It's sort of like a big magnet,
yeah,
where all the prey species are in one location, you know?
Interesting. And as I recall, because a lot of these fish were being forced up closer to the surface, fisheries, people who were out there doing commercial fishing, were reading this as that there were plentiful fish, but there really weren't.
What you end up with is overly optimistic catch, feeding, and effort data because the animals are squeezed and density in that part of the world is higher than others. And what you need to do is to correct for that.
Yeah, because it looks as though there are more fish there.
And there really are, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a map of the Atlantic Ocean between the west coast of Africa and the east coast, the part of South America that juts out. And it's showing that this hypoxia, this dead zone, so to speak, this is huge. This is not just along the coastline. This zone reaches practically... It's a band, a very wide band, across the entire Atlantic. Now, how do we stop this?
Well, you know, I'm not sure we do. First, the thing that sort of fuels a lot, but although I've never read it in a peer-reviewed paper, is the fact that dissolved oxygen in the oceans is inversely related to temperature. The higher the temperature,
uh-huh.
less dissolved oxygen that can be driven into the ocean.
So higher climate change.
There you go. And so it's getting warmer. And the surface of the water temperatures have been predicted by, you know, climate models to increase as much as even 5 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. Now, I was in a meeting in London called Earth Under Pressure. And a very well-known scientist who's... really a leader in the world in hypoxia. His name is Robert Diaz. Bob Diaz gave a talk there. I asked the question afterward, Bob, you know, as we sit here in this meeting in London, and all the projections of the temperature increasing by 5 degrees C, but if it even increases by half that amount, what would you predict in terms of the growth of the oxygen minimum zone, and what about our pelagic fisheries? And I was really shaken by his response. Well, Eric, the oxygen minimum zone in the Atlantic is going to start in North Africa and go all the way down to the tip of South Africa, and it's going to cover every single part of the eastern South American coast. He said, we're simply not going to have those fisheries.
Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Eric Prince is with the Southeast Fisheries and Science Center of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. For more information on his research, head to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Henry David Thoreau, who said, many men go fishing all their lives without knowing that it's not the fish that they're after. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Visit splendidtable.org to catch up on everything you heard here today and so much more. You can download podcasts, register for our giveaways, and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.